Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Litigation and Religious Liberties Practice Groups, was recorded on Monday, February 29, 2016, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group's telephone conference call, a preview of Whole Woman's Health, the Texas abortion case. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. We're very pleased to welcome two experts to our call today. We're going to hear opening remarks from each in turn, maybe some back and forth, but then, as always, questions from the audience. We'll begin today with Breanne Gorod. She is the Chief Counsel at the Constitutional Accountability Center. In addition to giving her a view on the case, she's going to give us some background on the case so she can take a few minutes of extra time. We're going to allot 10 to 12 minutes for that exercise. And then we'll hear from Lee Radofsky. He's the Solicitor General of the state of Arkansas. And with that, let's begin. Breanne Gorod.
Well, thank you, Dean. And I want to start by thanking the Federal Society for putting on this teleforum and for inviting me to participate. So by way of brief background, you know, Whole Woman's Health is a challenge to HB2. It's a Texas law that was enacted in 2013 that imposes a number of restrictions on abortion providers. And I think it's important to make clear at the outset that the Texas legislature was not writing on a blank slate when it enacted HB2. To the contrary, abortion was already highly regulated prior to the law's enactment. Among other things, Texas law has long required medical practices that provide 50 or more abortions per year to obtain what's called an abortion facility license. So licensed abortion facilities have to satisfy rigorous abortion standards. This includes requirements about personnel, infection control, patient rights, medical and clinical services, and anesthesia services. So on top of these and other requirements that already existed under Texas law, HB2 requires abortion clinics to meet the standards for standalone surgical centers. So significantly, even though most surgical centers in Texas aren't required to strictly comply with those standards, they can apply for waivers, which are readily given, licensed abortion facilities are not eligible for those waivers under state regulations. HB2 also provides that physicians who perform abortions have admitting privileges at a hospital within 30 miles of the abortion clinic. Under HB2, it is not sufficient, as it previously was, that the doctors have a working relationship with a physician who has those kinds of admitting privileges. So together, these two requirements will close more than 75% of Texas abortion facilities. They will also deter new facilities from opening, and this will make it substantially more difficult to obtain a legal abortion in the state of Texas. So I won't go into the whole somewhat lengthy procedural history of this litigation, but I think it's worth noting that a district court held a trial to consider the challenge to the law. This district court heard testimony from 19 witnesses, including 12 experts. Following that trial, the district court concluded that the great weight of the evidence established that before HB2's passage, abortion in Texas was extremely safe, with particularly low rates of serious complications and virtually no deaths occurring on account of the procedure. The district court also concluded that women will not obtain better care or experience more frequent positive outcomes at an ambulatory surgical center as compared to a previously licensed facility. And the district court also concluded that concerns about physician screening cannot justify the admitting privileges requirement because doctors in Texas have been denied privileges for reasons not related to clinical competency. So based on these findings and other factual findings, the district court concluded the law would impose an undue burden on abortion access, and it enjoined those requirements of HB2. A panel of the Fifth Circuit subsequently reversed that district court decision, holding that with a couple of limited exceptions, the law did not impose an undue burden, and it vacated most of the injunction the district court had put in place. Last June, the Supreme Court stayed the Fifth Circuit's decision pending the timely filing and disposition of a cert petition, so that stay remains in place today. So I wanted to go into that history, and in particular that history of the district court decision, because I think the factual findings by the district court really help explain why these restrictions are so plainly unconstitutional under the standards set out in the Supreme Court's decision in Planned Parenthood v. Casey. Before I go into that decision, I want to step back for a moment and discuss first principles and offer an account of why it is so important that courts do what the Fifth Circuit did not do in this case and meaningfully scrutinize state laws that impose restrictions on the ability to secure an abortion. So let's start with the text of Section 1 of the 14th Amendment. It provides that, quote, no state shall make or enforce any law which shall abridge the privileges or immunities of citizens of the United States, nor shall any state deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, nor deny to any person within its jurisdiction the equal protection of the laws. The framers of Section 1 chose this sweeping language to provide broad protection for substantive liberty, including rights beyond those specifically enumerated elsewhere in the Constitution. As Senator Jacob Howard, one of the amendment's drafters, explained, the fundamental rights of Americans, he said, quote, cannot be fully defined in their entire extent and precise nature, unquote. And the framers did this for a simple reason. They wrote the 14th Amendment against the backdrop of a long history of states abridging fundamental rights. They knew that during slavery and in the aftermath of the Civil War, a number of states were suppressing a whole host of fundamental freedoms. Fundamental aspects of personal liberty and bodily integrity were denied to the slaves on a daily basis. Whippings, forced separations of husbands and wives, and of parents and children, rape and compulsory childbearing were all a central part of the lives the slaves led. And so many of the rights at the core of the 14th Amendment were not specifically enumerated in the Constitution, but rather were basic rights essential to individual liberty and dignity. The Supreme Court has long enforced the original meaning of Section 1 of the 14th Amendment, interpreting the Due Process Clause to provide broad protections for substantive liberty. More than two decades ago in Planned Parenthood v. Casey, the Supreme Court reaffirmed that the Constitution guarantees a woman the right to end her pregnancy prior to viability. And the court explained that state abortion regulation is, in the court's words, doubly deserving of scrutiny, because the state has touched not only upon the private sphere of the family, but upon the very bodily integrity of the pregnant woman. So let me turn now to Casey and why these regulations so clearly fail the test that court decision sets out. In Casey, the Supreme Court adopted the undue burden standard as the appropriate means of reconciling the state's interest in protecting potential life with the woman's constitutionally protected liberty. Under the undue burden standard, an undue burden exists if the purpose or effect of a state law is to place a substantial obstacle in the path of a woman seeking an abortion before the fetus attains viability. The Texas restrictions, in my view, fail on both prongs of the undue burden test. I'll start with purpose. The purported purpose of the Texas restrictions is to protect women's health, but three factors make clear that this health rationale is pretextual. First, they are not reasonably designed to promote women's health. As I noted earlier, the district court held a lengthy trial. It heard from many experts, and the district court concluded that abortion was extremely safe in Texas prior to the law. It concluded the standards for ambulatory surgical centers are designed for surgeries far more complex than abortion, and that hospital admitting privileges are a poor indicator of physician competence. Moreover, the evidence showed that women who are delayed or prevented from accessing abortion services face greater health risks than those who are able to access early abortion care. Second, the undisputed effect of the requirements is to close the vast majority of Texas abortion facilities, and that provides further evidence of an impermissible purpose. And then third, and I think this is really significant, the Texas requirements single out abortion from all other outpatient procedures. They single them out for far more burdensome regulation. For example, Texas law explicitly authorized physicians to perform major outpatient surgeries, including those requiring general anesthesia, in their offices. So it's one thing to say that states can regulate abortion just like they regulate other medical procedures, but states can't single out abortion from comparable medical procedures for medical regulation that is difficult and more burdensome unless that regulation is aimed at something that is unique about abortion, and the laws here don't. And I think it's worth pausing here to focus on one of the most patently erroneous aspects of the Fifth Circuit decision. According to the Fifth Circuit, the undue burden standard doesn't require or even permit any scrutiny of the extent to which an abortion restriction advances a valid state interest. The Fifth Circuit insists that it's not the court's duty to second-guess legislative fact-finding, but that conclusion is completely at odds with Supreme Court precedent and the Constitution. In Casey, the court explained that greater scrutiny is required when governmental action intrudes upon a protected liberty. And in Gonzales v. Carhart, the court made clear that the court retains an independent constitutional duty to review findings where constitutional rights are at stake. So these Supreme Court cases accurately reflect the importance of the framers of the 14th Amendment attached to judicial review to safeguard personal individual rights. They understood that the greatest safeguard of liberty and of private rights is to be found in the fundamental law that secures those private rights, administered, they said, by an independent and fearless judiciary. They understood that one of the great fundamental rights possessed by all citizens was the right to enforce rights in the courts. Thus, the full promise of liberty guaranteed by the 14th Amendment would be an empty one if courts were permitted to rubber-stamp state laws that restrict individual liberty without meaningfully reviewing whether those laws were enacted to serve a legitimate legislative purpose. And then finally, I'll talk just really briefly about the effect prong of the undue burden test. The district court trial made clear that these requirements create substantial obstacles to abortion access that are not warranted by their impact on women's health. Each of these restrictions would drastically reduce the number and geographic distribution of abortion providers in Texas, substantially increasing the wait time for appointments at abortion facilities and the distances that many women would have to travel to reach those facilities. These delays in abortion access will impose heavy burdens on women. The Fifth Circuit essentially just dismissed these concerns, saying there's no substantial obstacle to accessing abortion if there's a single abortion provider within a 150-mile radius. It's wrong as a practical matter, and it's wrong as a legal matter. As a practical matter, the district court concluded that the practical impact on Texas women, due to the clinic's closure statewide, would operate for a significant number of women in Texas just as drastically as a complete ban on abortion. And as a legal matter, the court in Casey made clear that restrictions cannot be considered in a vacuum, and courts cannot blind themselves to the practical impact of the law. And that's what the Fifth Circuit sought to do here, and why, in my view, the court should reverse the judgment of the Fifth Circuit. Thanks very much. I look forward to hearing Lee's comments and to a discussion afterward. Thanks.
Lee Rudofsky, go right ahead with your opening remarks, please.
So, Dean, let me say thank you to you and the Federalist Society, and Breanne, thank you for joining us today and for the overview and your thoughts. I appreciate it. I guess I'll start where Breanne did with the 14th Amendment and originalism. I think the framers of the 14th Amendment would find it interesting, to say the least, to suggest that a practice that was banned at the time of the 14th Amendment in many states actually violated the 14th Amendment. I don't think that's a legitimate and useful argument. I think the framers of the 14th Amendment would suggest that banning abortions, prohibiting abortions, regulating abortions did not violate the 14th Amendment. But I'd really like to get into actually the case law. It may be a flip from a sort of traditional Federalist Society role. I think here this case is really going to come down to the case law, and to be perfectly honest, the elephant in the room is this case is going to come down to Justice Kennedy's vote. I think, given, of course, the unfortunate and sad passing of Justice Scalia, one would question, you know, whether his passing is going to change the outcome of this case. In terms of the result, I actually don't think it's going to change that much, because I think if Justice Kennedy is on board with the view that the regulation should be upheld as constitutional, then I think the vote will be a tie, which of course won't create an opinion, but will basically affirm what the Fifth Circuit did. I think if Justice Kennedy is not on board with that view, then the case will be reversed. The real question here, in my view, was Justice Kennedy serious in what he said in Casey? And I appreciate that Breanne, wants to argue that Casey clearly suggests this is unconstitutional. I will suggest the very opposite view. I will suggest that Roe and its progeny up until the time of Casey are really more the type of analysis that Breanne would like the courts to engage in, and Casey very specifically pulled back on that. Casey obviously overruled Roe to the extent that Roe had the trimester framework, and in overruling Roe, Casey was very clear that Roe and its progeny often interfered with a state legitimately protecting its interests, both its interest in potential life or the life of the child, said variously in various opinions, and obviously the preservation and maintenance of the health of the mother. And that's really where I want to suggest that this goes back to before HB 2 was passed. This goes back to Dr. Gosnell being accused of and then found guilty of late-term abortions, essentially convicted of murder for his actions in Pennsylvania. I think it's important to understand the context of what states were responding to when they created these laws. And Texas is not alone. There are numerous other states that have created these laws since Dr. Gosnell was convicted of murder. I think everybody agrees that there were some issues with the states being very concerned about how much they could regulate and they could audit facilities, and that is at least what led to the atmosphere of Dr. Gosnell feeling like he could get away with what he was doing without any real state oversight. To move back into the case law, Roe essentially set up the following test. It essentially said that in the second trimester, if you could show a rational basis and you could show that the law did not unduly burden a woman's right to choose, the law would pass scrutiny. However, in doing that, both Roe and its progeny took, I guess, what I would call a harder than rational basis look. Almost rational basis plus, if you will, look at what a state identified as both its reasons and its means for legislating to preserve the health of the mother or protect the life of the fetus or preserve its interest in the legitimate life of the fetus. What Casey did was refine that test. So obviously Casey reaffirmed Roe's idea that pre-viability, a woman ultimately has a right to choose to have an abortion. But Casey was very clear that that right does not include a right to be free from state interference, certainly in the pre-viability realm when the state is regulating in furtherance of its legitimate interests. And Casey and then its progeny very clearly set out a test that the Fifth Circuit has adopted. The first question is whether there is an undue burden on a woman's right to choose. And Brianne is exactly correct that the undue burden test is almost a misnomer. The definition of it and the plurality in Casey was very clear. It said undue burden is really a shorthand for the conclusion that a state regulation has the purpose or effect of placing a substantial obstacle in the path of a woman seeking an abortion of a non-viable fetus. If you do not create a substantial burden, that essentially means that you are not, as a state, regulating a woman's right to choose. And when you are not regulating a woman's right to choose, it makes perfect sense that the regulation, like any other state regulation, is subject to rational basis scrutiny. It's subject to the reasonably related to a legitimate state interest test. And what the plaintiffs here are attempting to do is move us back to a pre-Casey world. They're attempting to move us back to a world where the court gets to second-guess legislatures. It gets to say, look, we think the legislature got the medicine wrong. Maybe there's medical confusion in the debate. Maybe, quite honestly, common sense and the medical evidence might seem to disagree with each other, or there's a lot of medical evidence on the side against the state and only a small amount on the side for the state. And what plaintiffs would like you to understand and what plaintiffs would like the court to say is the district courts are the ones who can make that determination whether the legislature got it right. And that honestly not only goes against Casey, but it also goes against Gonzalez, and it also goes against Masaryk, the progeny of Casey. Those cases are very clear that where there's medical uncertainty, the legislature is allowed to choose a side, and they shouldn't be second-guessed. The other thing that I would like to talk about quickly, I guess two other points, is in terms of the purpose of placing a substantial obstacle in the path of a woman seeking an abortion, really that is the plaintiffs trying to get their heightened scrutiny through by other means. What they're suggesting there is that the court should infer a purpose from the lack of medical necessity. They're asking the court to say, we don't think this is medically necessary, and because we don't think it's medically necessary, we should assume or infer that there's a bad purpose here. That obviously is not what the case law says. It's not what the case law says in any other area, and it's not what the case law suggests here. The lack of evidence is not evidence of bad purpose. Moving on to the effects test, if you look at both the petition for certiorari, or should say the opposition to petition for certiorari, and the opposition brief of Texas, at least in the first two or three pages, it really lays out a quite fascinating chart that shows there is almost to the area going to be no change in the ability of women to get abortions in a particular location. So there used to be two facilities in a location, now there's one. There used to be three in a different geographic location, now there's two. Plaintiffs would obviously like to hobble together a whole number of professed harms, one being longer wait times, one being additional distance to travel. The problem is that runs headlong into both Casey and Casey's progeny. Casey and quite frankly even Roe were very clear that those type of effects, while they may be annoying, they may make it harder to get an abortion, those type of effects do not count as a substantial obstacle to a woman exercising her ultimate right to choose to have a pre-viability abortion. And I think with that, we'll probably throw it open to questions.
Very good. Thank you both. In a moment, you'll hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone to indicate you have a question. Once again, if you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Let me make a quick commercial announcement before we go to questions. And before we go to questions, I also want to give Brian Gorod a chance to respond. Our next scheduled teleforum conference call is Wednesday. It's a Courthouse Steps teleforum conference call on this same case where we'll be discussing what actually transpires during oral argument of the case. And then that's on Wednesday. And then on Friday, we'll be talking about the stay in the Clean Power Plan case. Today, of course, the preview of Whole Women's Health. If you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Before we turn to the audience, let me revert to Brian Gorod and give her a chance to respond briefly.
Sure, thanks. I'll start with, I think, the one point that Lee and I agree on, which is that I think Justice Kennedy's vote will be key in this case. And I think a good question is the one that Lee raises. Is Justice Kennedy serious about what he said in Casey? But obviously there's a lot of disagreement between Lee and myself on what exactly Casey means and how exactly it departed from Roe. I think what's important to understand about Casey is, Casey did say that the state can further its interest in protecting potential life, but it said it could do it in a very specific way, in a way that furthers the dignity of women by informing their choice. It can try to persuade them not to terminate a pregnancy. But what Casey made very clear is the state cannot impose a substantial obstacle on women accessing an abortion under the guise of protecting women's health. When that is the purported rationale of a state law, as it is here, the courts absolutely are supposed to engage in meaningful scrutiny to determine whether that purported rationale is pretextual, just like they would in any other context that involves a fundamental right. And I think, it's important to underscore, it's fundamental to the way our court system works that district courts engage in fact-finding, appellate courts and Supreme Court don't. The district court here engaged in a lengthy trial. It heard testimony from more than a dozen witnesses, and based on that trial, based on those expert witnesses, the court concluded here that abortion was extremely safe prior to the enactment of HB2, and that HB2 would not improve women's health. In fact, it would harm it by making it more difficult for women to access abortion. And then one final thought, just going to the question of how we can know, you know, what the purpose of this law was. I think it's important to emphasize, you know, that this law really singles out abortion for more onerous restrictions than are applied to comparable medical procedures. You know, as I noted earlier, you know, when it comes to ambulatory surgical centers, there are often and readily given waivers. The abortion licensing facilities cannot get the same waivers that are given to other facilities. These ambulatory surgical requirements are applied to abortion facilities that only engage in medical abortions, don't even engage in surgical procedures. So I think that just highlights the extent to which the law at issue here really is not about furthering women's health, but instead is simply about preventing women from being able to access abortion.
And now let me give Lee Radofsky another couple minutes to augment.
I'll just take a very short amount of time. I think the plaintiffs here are trying to fit a square peg into a round hole. I think they understand that under the rational basis test, they lose, and so they are looking for any possible way to get Justice Kennedy to move off of what I think was clearly his intent in Casey, which was to allow states where they are not creating a substantial obstacle to a woman's right to choose, to allow states to regulate as long as their regulation passed rational basis. And I think, look, the plaintiffs and Brianne have done a good job in briefing to provide the court, if, and quite frankly, Justice Kennedy, if he so chooses, a sort of tempting carrot of how to get around rational basis. Either one, they say, listen, just in terms of looking at the reasonable relationship, you should look closer and scrutinize the medicine more. And if you think the legislature made the wrong choice, then that can't be reasonably related. That's kind of the rational basis plus approach. And then the second point is by using this purpose prong of the substantial burden test, which quite frankly, Brianne called it sort of a sham or a pretext. And I think that's a useful moniker. I really do think the purpose part of the substantial obstacle test is limited and should be limited to when there is a complete sham. I think what the plaintiffs are trying to do is sort of drive a Mack truck through the purpose prong and suggest, well, that this is the way we can know if the purpose is really a bad purpose to harm women's ability to choose or to prevent women's ability to choose. The way we know that is if our district court thinks that the legislature made a bad decision when it weighed the medical evidence. That's a little bit of a caricature of the plaintiff's position, but it's honestly not much of a caricature. Here, I think the plaintiffs understand, and I'll stop after this, I think the plaintiffs understand that if the question is, does this impose, in effect, substantial burden, the answer is no. And the question is, if this is a rational basis, does it pass? The answer is yes. Under that view of Casey, which I honestly think is the best view of Casey, certainly it's the view that's consistent with Masaryk and Gonzalez after Casey, it is pretty clear that the state has the right to do what it has done here. I think the more difficult question to sort of tea leaf read is whether Justice Kennedy wants to hold to his, I guess, more states' right orientation in Casey, or whether he wants to move back towards the, I guess, what Brianne and others would call the sort of privacy right and liberty interest of their position. I'm honestly not sure where Justice Kennedy wants to go. I think looking at Casey and Gonzalez, there's a strong case that in this situation he will stay where he was in terms of his sort of states' rights orientation. Obviously, the thing that pushes against that is, you know, the four more liberal justices are usually very good at not taking cases unless they think they know where Justice Kennedy is coming out. So as a real politic matter, I'm a little bit concerned. As a legal matter and reading Justice Kennedy's views, I think there's enough there to not be too pessimistic.
All right. Once again, if you have a question in our audience, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. We've just got one question pending, but for now, let's take our first call of the day.
Yes, this is Stephen Casey with Texas Center for Defensive Life. And by way of disclaimer, I was a counsel on one of the amicus briefs. I just want to address the idea of a broad application of the 14th Amendment because I see that's what the plaintiffs are pushing for. And in light of that, the question I would have is if we are addressing a fundamental right, one of the interesting questions brought up by a recent 11th Circuit case, which was denied cert in February, was that the viability standard really is no standard at all because of evolving technologies. And so if that is the case, if evolving technologies are going to determine the life question, I want to pitch this and say that and suggest that it sounds in a different area of law. And I'll wait for your response after I pitch it, that this is an issue of a trespass of the fetus by right of private necessity because it made no choice to be put in the womb. It had no say in it. So it's very similar to someone getting kidnapped and dropped off in the middle of someone's field. And if that is, does the person who owns the field have the right to shoot them if they don't want to bear the time while the person transits to the edge of the field and gets off their property? And so I'll go offline and wait for your response.
Who wants to respond to that?
Brianne, you want to take a shot or you want me to?
Well, I'm interested to hear what you have to say. I mean, I guess my view is it's an interesting theory. I mean, I don't see the court meaningfully departing from the approach that it's taken in Roe and Casey and Gonzalez. I mean, obviously, there's been some evolution in the way the court has talked about abortion and the test that is applied. But I think, you know, what we're going to see in this case in particular is a reaffirmation of Casey. And, you know, as I've said, and obviously Lee disagrees, I think, you know, Kennedy will reaffirm the principle set out in Casey. And I think Casey, you know, as I've said, establishes a balance that, you know, respects both the state interest, but also the privacy and liberty and equality interests of women. And I think that Kennedy is very likely to, in applying that balance, recognize that the law at issue here goes too far and has, in the words of Casey, poses a substantial obstacle on women accessing their right to abortion.
I'm honestly pretty much where Brianne is on this, at least on the first part of her answer,
yeah.
Which is, and I, you know, I should actually provide two disclaimers too. The first is Arkansas is an amicus brief in this, you know, in the whole women's health case. We've joined the brief of states. There's a competing brief of states too, but we've joined the brief of states that asks the court to uphold as constitutional Texas's laws or regulations. But I guess the other disclaimer is, we just finished not getting cert in our fetal heartbeat or human heartbeat law case. And going through that process, I will say it is pretty clear at this point, and certainly probably even clearer with the passing of Justice Scalia, that the court is not going to, in the near future, take up the question of whether the viability doctrine should be changed or is wrong, or even with technology and technological advances, is going to sort of push up against the kind of logical end of where the viability doctrine should have us. I just think they are not interested. I think, you know, if we talk about 5 years from now, 10 years from now, when technological advances may truly push viability very early, I think one of the great ironies in life is at some point, folks like the plaintiffs are not going to be happy with the viability theory and are going to suggest that the viability theory doesn't protect a woman's right to choose enough, but for purposes of your question, I don't think we're changing anything about the viability doctrine anytime soon.
And I'll follow up just to provide a disclaimer while we're doing that, that the Constitutional Accountability Center also filed an amicus brief in the case in support of the plaintiffs, arguing that the text and history of the 14th Amendment make clear both the fundamental nature of the right and also why courts need to engage in meaningful scrutiny of restrictions like the type at issue here.
Once again, if you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. We've got just one question pending, and our lines are wide open. Let's take another call.
Hi, this is Jay DeSanto. I'm a litigation associate in Washington, D.C. I'm interested in knowing what the state's rationale is for treating the abortion clinics any differently from other medical clinics and centers. I guess I'm just interested in knowing that aspect of the case.
So I'll take this one, or at least to start. I want to start by admitting that I am not steeped in the hardcore factual details of
sure.
this case. I mean, I understand what the district court said, but I certainly did not sit there and read all the testimony. Having said that, especially under rational basis review, if it turned out that it is true that the legislature has done this for abortion and in no other area, obviously the response, and quite frankly, again, at the rational basis level, I think it's a perfectly valid response, is abortion provides concerns for the woman's health, concerns that are not necessarily applicable in every other situation, especially considering the potential lack of resources or lack of availability of abortion doctors. And I quite specifically don't use the term abortionist. I really abortion doctors. And second, and perhaps even moreover, I think part of the importance in understanding the context of the state's response here is what caused the response, and Dr. Gosnell's really grotesque violation of any kind of medical ethics and human decency in the abortion context, in the late-term abortion context, which essentially, look, even the jury said, constituted nothing short of murder. I think that is what they were responding to. They were responding to a specific abortion-related issue and the lack of standards, and I think, again, especially in the rational basis realm, they can do that.
I guess I'll just respond to say first, I mean, I think it's clear, as I noticed mentioned at the very outset, you know, it's not the case that abortion was unregulated prior to the enactment of HB 2. I mean, to the contrary, abortion was highly regulated in the state of Texas, and I think it's worth underscoring again what the district court concluded, which is that abortion in Texas was an incredibly safe procedure with very few complications. The district court also concluded, and this is consistent with the overwhelming weight of medical evidence, that abortion is safer than most of the comparable medical, most if not all the comparable medical procedures that are regulated less strictly than abortion now is in the state of Texas. And I think that does go to both the state's, the impermissibility of the state's purpose in enacting HB 2.
This is Lee. If it's okay, Dean, I just want to follow up on that, and obviously
yep.
Brianne
go right
follow
ahead.
Up
yeah.
if she wants. Look, I think part of what this comes down to is who decides. You'll notice that Brianne said the overwhelming weight of medical evidence, the district court concluded, said one thing. I think from that, Brianne's point of view and the plaintiff's point of view would be the district court that gets to make the decision about what the weight of the medical evidence shows, and if it's against what the if it's different from what the legislature thought, then the answer is there must have been a pretext. I think what I would argue is by saying the overwhelming weight of the medical evidence, you're automatically suggesting or you're automatically conceding that there is some medical evidence to the contrary. And in the area where there's medical uncertainty, the legislature is the one, at least in this context, when you're not when you're not creating a substantial obstacle in effect, the legislature is the one that gets to decide which medical evidence it's going to believe.
Well, I'm definitely not conceding anything, but I think what is important here is I think you're right that what key to this case is who gets to decide. But I think the Supreme Court has made clear, consistent with what the Constitution requires, is that when fundamental rights are at stake, the courts are supposed to engage in meaningful scrutiny of regulations and laws that make it more difficult for individuals to access those rights. And in our court system, district courts are the courts that are equipped to gauge in fact-finding, to hear witnesses, to consider evidence. And so it is highly significant that the district court here held a trial, considered the evidence, and concluded that the regulations at issue will not further women's health, and to the contrary, will harm women's health by making it substantially more difficult for many women to access abortions.
This is Dean. Once again, if you have a question, our lines are wide open at this point. Push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. We have plenty of time for more questions. Let me ask, we've heard a lot about the, while we're waiting to see if others ring in here, again, star button and then the pound button if you have a question. We've heard a lot about the tests, the test that the court should use in reviewing this. I've heard rational basis. I've heard rational basis plus, both from Lee Radofsky and from Brianne Gorod. We've heard, I think, meaningful scrutiny. Do the two of you agree on what the proper level of scrutiny is? I'm not sure what meaningful scrutiny is and maybe what rational basis plus is, except that they're both maybe something less than heightened scrutiny and something more than rational basis. What is the correct test here? And for each of you, what setting this case aside, maybe for Brianne Gorod, what would pass the test? What, in other words, what sort of regulation can the state engage in? And for Lee, what sort of regulation by the state would be would fail the test? Would be too much?
Well, to start, I think it's clearly, and I don't agree on what the standard is.
Right.
I mean, I'll revert back. I mean, I want to just apply what Casey says. You know,
does Casey say meaningful scrutiny? Is that the shorthand that the court uses, or is that something that we just use in discussions here?
You know, I can't remember offhand whether that exact phrase is used in Casey or not. I mean, what Casey says is, you know, an undue burden exists if its purpose or effect is to place a substantial obstacle in the path of a woman seeking an abortion before the fetus attains viability. And it, you know, also says that, you know, greater scrutiny is required when governmental action intrudes upon a protected liberty. I'll note also that Gonzalez says that, you know, the court retains an independent constitutional duty to review findings where constitutional rights are at stake. So I think, you know, all of that makes clear that courts cannot, should not simply rubber stamp the findings of legislatures, whatever they may be. You know, in terms of what, you know, would pass muster, I mean, I think it would really depend on, you know, what evidence is available. And, you know, I don't think I want to speculate on particular restrictions that a state might impose in the absence of the kind of fact-finding that district court is equipped to do.
So Dean, first of all, I agree with Brianne that we don't agree on the test. Second of all, I think this actually, the question of what the test is, it's almost better done at the 30,000-foot level, because you really have to go back and try to figure out what Casey changed in Roe. And my view is that Casey did not just change the trimester test. It didn't just say sort of we're getting rid of the trimester framework and that's it. Casey actually changed the right. Now it did it subtly, but I guess what I would say is it explained better, I think, the right that is at issue. What Casey clearly said was the right was a woman's ability at the end of the day to make the ultimate decision to terminate her pre-viability abortion. That is the right. It's not the right to do it without interference with the government. It's not the right to, you know, feel good doing it. It's not the right to do it wherever she wants to do it. And so in my view, what Casey really did, and by the way, I will concede, I hope Brianne would concede this too, maybe she wouldn't, that Casey is not, at least the plurality, is not the best written opinion ever, and there are certainly, you know, small parts of strands of Casey that you can read one way or the other, but I think the best reading is that if what the state has done before viability in regulating abortion does not create a substantial obstacle, again, they used the word undue burden test, but then they went on and defined it, does not create a substantial obstacle preventing a woman from exercising her ultimate right to choose, then it isn't infringing on the right itself. And because it's not infringing on the right itself, it's not subject to any level of heightened scrutiny. It should be subject to rational basis scrutiny. So essentially, the substantial burden test is almost the analysis the court goes through to figure out whether this burdens a right or not. And I think if you look at the test, or at least I should say, if you look at Casey as talking about and fixing the right in the way I've framed it, then it makes perfect sense why, if there's no substantial obstacle, then you only use rational basis because you're dealing with something that's not a constitutional right. Now, the really, I guess, interesting part of that, or where the rubber hits the road, is the substantial obstacle test is not just an effects test. It has this extra statement in it that it talks about the purpose or effect. And in my view, of course, that's what the plaintiffs are sort of trying to use as the big loophole to drive the Mack truck through. What I would say about that, however, is I think the term the purpose or is really limited to truly sham purposes. I mean, when there is very, very clear evidence that the legislature was completely acting as a sham, and it's not a big enough loophole to sort of drive a truck through that says, well, in order to figure out whether it's a sham, we really need to have a meaningful review of, you know, of the medical evidence. I think really the heart of the substantial burden test or substantial obstacle test is the effects prong. The purpose prong is a very, very limited and small point to make sure that states aren't, creating true shams. Now, plaintiffs may think this really is a sham. I don't think it would truly meet that heightened test. And so given that there's no substantial obstacle, I think rational basis is the right way to look at the substance of the regulation.
I'll just say two quick things in response to that. I mean, one, I think in looking at Casey and what it did differently than Roe, I mean, I think one thing that is really key is a distinction Casey drew between two types of abortion restrictions. On the one hand, restrictions that are designed to persuade women, that are designed to inform women, I think Casey took a much more favorable view of those kinds of restrictions. What Casey made clear is that states cannot impose a substantial obstacle on women obtaining an abortion just by saying, oh, this furthers women's health, even if that is not actually the case. That's what I think the undue burden, the substantial obstacle test Casey sets out, is designed to do, and that is why courts need to engage in scrutiny of laws that purport to further a woman's health. And the second thing I'll say is I think it defies common sense really to say that these restrictions, which would close 75% of abortion facilities in Texas, which would require, you know, women to drive, you know, hundreds of miles in order to obtain an abortion, don't impose a substantial obstacle on many, many, many women in the state of Texas securing an abortion or exercising their constitutional right. And I'd point folks to the appendix to the plaintiff's brief in the court, which at the very back of the brief includes a map of the state of Texas. It shows where licensed abortion facilities exist and where ambulatory surgery centers exist. And I think that map makes clear just how few geographic parts of the state will have facilities that offer abortions if HB2 goes into effect.
So I think
Lee, if you don't mind if I break in, just to let you both know that we've got a couple questions pending now. But if you wanna respond, go ahead, Lee Burdett.
I guess 2 seconds. Or I shouldn't say that. That's terrible. 30 seconds. I think the substantial obstacle effects test is very, very hard to meet here, despite what the plaintiffs and what Breanne is saying. I think their arguments run headlong into Casey, which very clearly says that increased costs, increased travel time, decreased availability of medical care are incidental burdens and are not the type of burdens that cause a substantial effect. Now, I would agree, and I think even the Fifth Circuit agrees, that there's a logical stopping point to that argument when, you know, if you're talking about, I know that's not this case, you're talking about 600 miles and you have to make 6 trips and you have to spend 4 days there every time. I think there are clearly some things that would amount to substantial obstacles, but I think, at least under Casey, they would. But I think given Casey's approval of 150-mile round trip, even if there's a 24-hour waiting period, which suggests some women have to do it twice, that is not a substantial obstacle. I think the plaintiff's arguments are not particularly well-placed given what the case law says.
All right. We've got 2 questions pending, as I mentioned, about 10 minutes left, so let's take another caller now.
Hi, this is Roger Severino from the Heritage Foundation. The discussion has talked a lot about the regulation of abortion, but I think it misses the point a little bit. HB2 doesn't regulate abortion per se. It regulates abortion clinics, which a very different question. And my question is, isn't that taking a static view, saying that so many facilities will change, will drop out, when there's a dynamism to it? Other facilities will take up the slack, you would imagine, in a free market. There's money to be made. And facilities that do less than 50 abortions per year aren't regulated as clinics at all, and they're not touched by HB2. So what do you make of the argument that, give it time, no matter what, how many clinics close, there will be other clinics or other avenues to take up the slack?
Brianne?
I guess two thoughts. I mean, one, I'm not sure that there's any evidence that that is right. I mean, I think, you know, you're assuming that just because licensed abortion facilities exist, that ambulatory surgery centers that are held to a much higher standard, notably one that, you know, most facilities that engage in more substantial surgeries don't meet, will be able to fill the void. And I think there's just no evidence to support that. And then I guess the other issue is, you know, you say in, you know, the fullness of time, but I mean, I guess the question is how long it would take for that to happen, even if it were to happen. And the question is, you know, now whether women are being denied their constitutional right by a law that does not further women's health and that will, in fact, harm their health.
Roger, I think, although I could be wrong, I think you may be doing the courthouse steps one discussion on this. If I'm right, I would certainly be interested if that at all came up at oral argument. I think as a development of the law question, I think you're probably right, and I think that is hopefully the way the law will go long term. I don't think that is at all what this case is going to turn on, and I don't think that's at all what's going to interest the members of the court and certainly the swing justice here, for lack of a better term. I do think one thing that's interesting that we probably haven't talked about and that I'm actually hopeful we're going to get clarity from the Supreme Court about is whether when you look at the substantial obstacle portion of the test, you are allowed to look across state lines. So one of the interesting issues here is that one of the facilities in Texas, one of the areas that would not have a facility if these regulations were enforced, is close to Oklahoma, where there is at least one abortion clinic. And the question is, and the district court below said that you can't look outside your state lines. And there's actually some case law on that. I don't think it's right, and I'm not sure it means everything the district court thinks it means. But there's some case law that says you can't look outside your state boundaries to determine whether there's a constitutional regulation or unconstitutional regulation. The Fifth Circuit said that's just wrong. As a matter of practice and sort of practical realities, if we're looking on about what the substantial effect is on a woman's right to choose, if the closest clinic is 500 miles away in Texas but is 10 minutes away in Oklahoma, the idea that we would blind our eyes, and I don't mean Oklahoma, guys, I apologize, New Mexico, and, you know, it's 5 minutes away in New Mexico, the idea that we wouldn't look at that and say there's no substantial burden because there's a clinic 5 minutes across the border is basically silly and sort of is kind of like hiding your head in the sand. I do think at the end of the day the Supreme Court may get to that issue, and I'm hopeful they do and resolve it, because it's an issue that I think will sort of go on and on in the substantial obstacle effects prong of this test.
Brianne, did you want to jump in on this point?
I mean, I think I'd just say two things really quickly. I mean, one is, you know, Lee mentioned, I mean, there is some case law on this point. I think that case law is right. I mean, Texas can't look to New Mexico or to other neighboring states to cure constitutional violations that its laws create. But I think Lee's also right that, you know, there is obviously room for additional guidance from the court. I mean, I'm hopeful that we will get that guidance in the form of a 5-3 decision with Justice Kennedy voting with the court's more progressive justices. But, you know, to the extent that that's not the case, I think it also underscores the importance of the Supreme Court vacancy and it being filled so that we can, you know, not have a series of 4-4 deadlocks that prevent the court from providing guidance on, you know, important issues raised by this issue and a host of others.
Looks like our final question got answered without being asked, or maybe it duplicated Roger Severino's question. You brought up, Lee, the Courthouse Steps Teleforum. It is featuring Roger Severino. It is Wednesday at 3 p.m. Roger, I know you're still on the line. I don't know if you have a follow-up question or point to make.
I'll save it for actual oral argument. Thanks.
Okay, sure thing. Once again, if you have a question, if you're in the audience, push the star button and the pound button if you'd like to ask the final question of the day. I don't see a final question. We've got about 5 minutes left, so let me give each of you 2 minutes to express a final thought, and let's go in the order in which we opened. Brianne Gorod.
Well, thank you again, you know, Dean and Lee, and to the Federal Society for what I think has been a great conversation about, obviously, a very important case that lots of people are interested in. You know, I think one thing that is clear is Lee and I disagree on a lot about Casey and the nature of these restrictions and their effect on women. I mean, I will just underscore that I think Casey makes very clear both that the state cannot, under the guise of a health regulation, impose restrictions, the purpose or effect of which is to place a substantial obstacle in the path of a woman seeking an abortion. And I think, you know, it is of critical importance here that there was a district court trial. The district court heard witnesses, it considered evidence, and it concluded, based on all of that evidence, that the restrictions here are not necessary and are not designed to promote women's health. The court concluded that abortion in Texas has been extremely safe. It is already regulated in Texas. It is extremely safe. And the undisputed effect of these requirements is to make it substantially more difficult for women to access an abortion, and that they will not do anything to further women's health. Given that, given the court's decision in Casey and in other cases making clear that there does need to be independent review of findings where constitutional rights are at stake, I hope that the Supreme Court will reverse the Fifth Circuit decision and reinstate the injunction put in place by the district court.
Lee Radofsky, a final thought.
So I'm not going to do a summary. What I am going to do is just sort of give a couple of things that I think people should be watching for in oral argument, and maybe Roger can report on some of them. As a sort of hint of where the court is going and whether the court's going to address some big issues. Obviously, the test is the first big issue. I think a lot of the ground here is, you know, who wins the right version of the test. I think a lot will flow from that. The second question is if there's a big discussion about medical uncertainty and what that means. There are really two strands of the cases law, you know, of the case law here, and I think they're somewhat dueling. I think there is certainly pre-Casey and maybe even in some post-Casey cases, there's a little bit less of a desire from the court to say, okay, there's medical uncertainty, so we're not going to second-guess the legislature. There's a little bit of a desire to second-guess the legislature, but then there is another strand of cases that is quite clear, and I think Gonzalez really speaks to this, that if there's medical uncertainty, the legislature gets to decide. I think those, if there are questions on that, it will be very interesting to see where who they're from and what they're arguing about or what they're asking about. The second one is what evidence is needed to prove a substantial obstacle in terms of the purpose effect of that test, and specifically is sort of the absence of a good reason, affirmative proof of a bad reason. The third one is, or I guess I should say the fourth one, is if there's conversation about facial versus as-applied challenges, that's been a somewhat sort of unanswered question in Supreme Court abortion jurisprudence. Obviously, in other contexts, the sort of facial test is it unconstitutional in all or nearly all circumstances? In the abortion context, for a long time, they really didn't have any kind of facial limitation. Now the limitation is it unconstitutional in a law, or will there be a substantial obstacle in a large fraction of cases in which the law is relevant? What's unclear is what it means by in which the law is relevant. I think the Fifth Circuit opinion is interesting on this point. I think the way the plaintiffs style this is they basically almost always have the denominator of the fraction be what the numerator is because they have a very narrow view of where the law is relevant. I think the state obviously would have a larger view. I don't know that the court's going to tackle it, but if they do, that could add some clarity in that area. And then the final one, and this is really one just because of how the court is currently constituted without Justice Scalia, I would be interested to see if there are any questions about res judicata and the effect. There was a whole part of this case that we haven't talked about because it's a little less sexy, I guess. Was there preclusion because the plaintiffs could have brought this case in a prior case or with a prior case and they didn't? I don't think that was an issue that was really going to be talked about, but now with Justice Scalia's passing, I have a small sense that maybe Chief Justice Roberts, is going to try to fashion a agreement to kick this case down the road, and decide it on res judicata grounds and wait for the next iteration of this. That's it for me.
Thank you so much, both of you. This is Dean Reuter thanking both of our guests, Brian Gorod and Lee Radofsky. This has been a most enlightening discussion. I certainly appreciate it. I want to thank as well our listeners for dialing in and for their thoughtful questions. A reminder that our next scheduled Teleforum conference call, we've alluded to it twice already, is this Wednesday at 3 o'clock, the same day this case will be heard in oral argument. At 3 o'clock Eastern Time, we'll welcome back Roger Severino to discuss this. But until that next Teleforum conference call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.